Disregarding Izzardiaga's categorical thumbs down, I flew to North Carolina to see Mitnick.
I had heard security on Mitnick was tight, and that no one but the Raleigh public defender had been to see him.
I wasn't on his visitation roster. I knew he didn't like me much, and my chances probably weren't as good as those of a total stranger. But it was worth a try. I wrote Mitnick, offering him the chance to correct any errors of fact. There was no response, so I decided to deliver to him a copy of the book myself. At least, that was the ostensible mission. For years he had been like a phantom in my life. Now, at least, I knew where to find him.
When I arrived in Raleigh, I dawdled a bit before setting out to the jail, which is in the town of Smithfield, about 30 miles east of the city.
I drove to the Players Club apartment complex, where Mitnick had been living when he was arrested. Set in the lush Carolina pines, the neo-colonial apartments are clean and new, the grounds immaculate. From the balcony of his $550-a-month bedroom unit, Mitnick had had a view of a nearby state forest. I could imagine his relief at arriving here, with the possibility and promise of nearby Research Triangle Park, the area's own Silicon Valley. My mind wandered to something I had read in a newspaper article. The search of Mitnick's place after the arrest had produced a book on the best companies to work for in America and 44 job application letters. I drove past farms and trailer parks. The closer I got to Smithfield, the more convinced I became of the futility of my journey, and having skirted the lawyer, I couldn't help but feel a bit naughty. When a police car pulled out of a parking lot and followed close at my tail for several miles, I could imagine what Mitnick must have felt every time he saw a cop. As I entered Smithfield, a billboard advertising Zima Gold greeted me. "Kiss your expectations goodbye." Smithfield is a sleepy, amiable place. I wouldn't have been surprised to see Andy and Opie ambling down the main street. The window of the town's computer store was rather inappropriately adorned with a toy swimming pool and plastic dolls in bathing suits propped next to a few PC programs. The local library, with hardly anyone in it, was filled with racks of well-thumbed paperbacks. Around the corner from the jail, the local movie theater was showing Bad Boys. The jail itself, part of a complex that includes the country courthouse and sheriff's office, is smack in the middle of town. I pushed the intercom button and explained to a disembodied woman's voice that I was here to deliver a book. "Are you immediate family?" she asked. "No," I said, and tried to explain, but she cut me off. "We don't accept books for federal prisoners," she said. "They have to go through the mail or the marshal's office has to approve it." I walked next door to the sheriff's office, found a pay telephone, and called the marshal's office. "Well," said the deputy marshal I reached, "if the U.S. Attorney's Office has nothing against you giving him a book, neither do I." I called the U.S. Attorney's Office. "I don't have a say in who can visit," the assistant U.S. attorney in charge of the case told me. "Call the defense attorneys."
I called the Public Defender's Office in Raleigh, but was told that Mendick's attorney was in a meeting.
I called the marshal back. "I'll call the captain," he said. "Give me 5 minutes." The wall had cracked. I walked into the sheriff's office, and within a few minutes, an accommodating man in uniform was whisking me upstairs. The bars closed behind us. "Shouldn't I sit in here?" I asked, pointing to the visitor's room. "Oh no, don't bother with that," he replied, and directed me straight into the warden's office. "Come right in here." Southern hospitality at its finest. Bars, floor to ceiling, painted yellow and blue, were everywhere. Jailers sat around, passing the time of day. The captain told them to retrieve Mitnick. One of the jailers stepped into the hallway, cupped his hands together, and yelled at a glass-enclosed warden's booth. "Nitwick!" The others corrected him. "Mitnick! Mitnick!" he repeated. Mitnick emerged a few moments later. He was wearing a bright orange jumpsuit that was several sizes too large over a turquoise t-shirt. An ensemble that struck me as incongruously cheerful. His brown, wavy hair, pulled back into a small ponytail, was in a frenzy. He had gone 3 or 4 days without shaving. Otherwise, his face had a healthy ruddiness to it. As he approached me, he looked suspicious and baffled. "Kevin, I'm Katie Hafner," I stammered, and held up the book like an ID card. The skepticism melted from his face, and he smiled. "I recognize you from your picture," he said, evidently referring to the book's dust jacket. "You're the last person I expected to see. I didn't know who they were calling me out for, and you're the last person I expected to see." He then stopped himself and backed away a bit. "I can't talk to you, under no circumstances, orders from my attorneys." He stopped himself again. "How did you get in? Even my friends can't get in." I mumbled something about the book. "I can't say anything to you," he repeated. "I have charges pending." Then he laughed. "You are persistent, aren't you?" I suppressed the urge to reply in kind. I gave him the book and told him to look over it and let me know what he'd like to change. "Just what you want to be given. The book you hate," I joked. "How'd you get in?" he repeated. He obviously was impressed by the feat. I hadn't social engineered my way in, exactly, but he no doubt suspected it. He was smiling and began to laugh again, a genuine friendly laugh. I laughed too. I wasn't surprised by how much I liked him. None of the wardens, seated in an adjacent office, seemed to be paying any attention to our hallway meeting. "If my attorneys say I can talk to you, I will," he said. He disappeared back into the cell block, then re-emerged a couple of minutes later, wearing the same gloomy look that he had when he came out the first time. He pressed the book back into my hands. "They told me to give you the book back, and they want to talk to you." A young warden showed me into a room with a telephone, and the two of us spent several minutes wrestling with the problem of a calling card call. I nearly suggested we call Mitnick in for assistance. When I got through to Izardiaga, who was on a speakerphone with another attorney helping with the case, he was livid. The two attorneys ordered me to leave the book with the jailer and leave the building at once, as if my very presence implicated their client. But I wanted to say goodbye in person. I asked the wardens to call him out again. "He says you can have it," I said when he returned. I handed him the book, and he held out his hand. "It was nice to meet you," he said as we shook hands. With that, he turned on his heels, lifting his hand in a friendly, slightly sorrowful wave. The large steel door opened to reclaim him, and he disappeared. When I returned my rental car at the airport, the budget clerk, a young man in his 20s, eager for small talk, asked where I had been. "At the county jail in Smithfield," I replied, and I explained the reason for the visit. He seemed fascinated, but mystified. "Have you heard about this guy, Jim?" he asked his colleague, an older man who had been nodding solemnly as I spoke. "Yep, he was arrested right around here," and pointed in the direction of the Players Club apartments. "He stole a whole bunch of credit cards." I began to explain that Mitnick hadn't used any of the credit cards, that the whole case wasn't so simple. But then the shuttle came. I said goodbye and stepped onto the bus.